You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, November 25th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I am sitting here in the studio a good 3 or 4 days out from today, Friday, with my belt undone, my pants unbuttoned. I just couldn't help myself when it came to that pecan pie, or the pumpkin pie, or the chocolate pie, or the cheesecake, or the cookies, or the ice cream, or the candy canes that I found in my suitcase from when we went to Michigan for Christmas last year. Had those. I'm quite full. And I'm rolling around now trying to deal with the cramping that I'm feeling in my gut. But that doesn't mean that you won't get fresh content today from the Majority Report. I hope your Thanksgiving was joyous. And today, on the Majority Report, the final installment, after now, after today, everything will be released from that 12-hour marathon show. Hours 9, 10, and 11 of the marathon program that I did last Thursday, still relevant, still fresh, the issues still burning. And some of the phone calls, some of the updates, of course, will be just a look back. And so for you today, ladies and gentlemen, the great Digby from the blog Hullabaloo, always intelligent, always smart, Digby. And, of course, Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone magazine. That is an amazing show. That's an amazing show to get for free. But if you are a Majority Report member right now, or if you become one right now, or now, or even sometime later in the future, you're not just going to enjoy Matt Taibbi and Digby. Oh, no. You're going to enjoy Digby. Catherine Harris called back later in the day. Actually, Janine Garofalo. Former Majority Report producer Josh Orton. Bill Scher, Campaign for America's Future and Liberal Oasis, longtime friend of show. Former Majority Report producer Stephen Sherrill. Reporter Michael Tracy. Voiceover guy, voice of the Majority Report.
FUBAR, America's right-wing nightmare.
Of course, I'm speaking about H. John Benjamin. You may know him as Archer on the show Archer, or Bob on the show Bob's Burgers on Fox. Or maybe you knew him as Coach McGurk on Home Movies. Or maybe you knew him as Ben on Dr. Katz. Or maybe you know him as John Benjamin on John Benjamin Has a Van on Comedy Central. But you surely know him as
FUBAR, America's right-wing nightmare.
The voice of the Majority Report and a longtime friend of mine. Grew up Worcester together. I used to beat him up at bar mitzvahs. That's not important. What's important is that he is part of this show offering. And, of course, Matt Taibbi. We also hear from Jessica, our wonderful and charming booker,
And we got a whole bunch of crazy calls, including one from my sister. Not to imply that you're crazy, sis. But you are. Don't tell anybody. So, folks, enjoy the final installment, and I will be back live on Monday. If you're traveling back home, have safe travels, and see you on Monday.
Let's drill, baby, drill, not stall, baby, stall.
That woman is an idiot.
Here it is, the Republicans' health care plan for America. Don't get sick.
If you think that's a fair ad, okay, then you're a Republican and an asshole. Have at it, Hoss. Be in that party. Despicable, man.
They're the bad guys.
Endless taxpayer bailout.
Yeah, that's not true.
When Obama won, the reason why we worked so hard for him, we didn't want a garden variety politician. Taking a stand, not just cutting deals.
That's what vision is. Yeah. That's what vision is.
The Best of the Left podcast. The best of the truly liberal media. Edited, organized, and mixed. Only at bestoftheleft.com.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Sam Seder on the award-winning Majority Report. I guess the podcast awards are Saturday night, and I'm going to Skype in or something like that. I'm not exactly 100% sure. We are now well past hour eight, well, 6 minutes past hour eight, into our ninth hour of our 12-hour marathon. I would say that my chances of making it probably now have risen to about 35% throughout the entire 12 hours. But here to help me is one of my favorite bloggers, and she has been my one of my favorite bloggers for longer than I even knew who she was. Of course, I'm talking about Digby from the blog Hullabaloo. At digbysblog.blogspot.com. Welcome to the program, Digby.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Happy anniversary.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Now, so, Digby, it's been a little time since we spoke. And, you know, we spent a big portion of this year sort of, there's actually been times where I would just send you an email and say, hey, do you want to come on tomorrow to talk about the horridness? And we both knew what I was talking about. Am I wrong to have a little more optimism now, or am I kidding myself?
Well, I don't think you're wrong. I mean, look at what's happening today. I mean, I think that's the big thing that's changed. I mean, I don't know that it's hit the dynamic in Washington yet. They seem to be living in their little austerity bubble without any interruption so far. But, you know, this eventually has to penetrate, I think, something this dramatic. And so I think that that's very hopeful. I mean, if this wasn't happening and we were just observing what was going on in D.C., and by the way, we should be because, you know, they're about to dismantle the safety net and, you know, do some pretty horrible things. But if that was it, I would be, you know, definitely getting ready to leap off the Brooklyn Bridge instead of walking across it, because it is, it is horrible. But if
this wasn't going on, today would have been a 12-minute show. That's the way, yeah, I would have treated this anniversary. I would have done 12 minutes instead of 12 hours. But let's talk about what's happening in Congress, because to a large extent, I mean, let's just keep this on sort of a broader level. One of the things that's been sort of fascinating about this is that I have found that not just because I didn't want to follow what was going on in Congress and not because I didn't want to follow the election, but in some way, the growth of this movement in some way takes the pressure off of what's happening in Washington, because that seems really near term to me, as opposed to the, to this movement, which seems longer term to me. Does that make any sense?
Sure. Sure. Although I think that, you know, I would suggest that probably we have to do both, because the damage that they are about to wreak in Washington is pretty severe and pretty long term. I mean, this is going to be very difficult to reverse if they succeed in doing this level of slashing of government. It's all part of the same thing, as we know. I mean, clearly this whole, the 99% and Occupy and the fact that the 1% income inequality is feeding into this dysfunction in Washington. I mean, it's all part of the same problem. So I think it has to be attacked from both directions. I was noticing today watching the pundits on TV that, you know, they're all observing this and going, well, this is terrific. Everybody's done a great job. And then I'm talking about pundits from both parties. But now, you know, maybe it's time to leave Wall Street alone. And I'm kind of screaming here in the void, no, no, you have to keep focus on that. This kind of local focus that's coming from all over the country today. They're occupying banks. They're doing these marches. They're doing, you know, all this work on a local and regional level that's truly important for making this, for putting pressure on the politicians. I mean, it hasn't reached them yet, but I'm hopeful that it will. I mean, and reaches them in a really visceral way, which is that, you know, it starts affecting their constituents, meaning, you know, big business and the Wall Street and the masters of the universe. But that's kind of where the pressure has to come from. So I think this is a brilliant way of doing it. Having said that, what is happening right now currently, we have to keep at least one eye on it because they are in a position to do a tremendous amount of damage that will affect real people with real issues in the here and now. I mean, you know, the old John Maynard Keynes line, you know, in the long run it'll all work out, but of course in the long run we'll all be dead.
Right.
That's, you know, that's a problem because a lot of people will suffer in the short to medium term,
right,
even if the Occupy Wall Street movement manages to create systemic change.
Well, let's turn to that a little bit. Now, but not without first saying too that I think the interesting thing is going to come in terms of pressure on our politicians, and hopefully it won't be too late because we'll talk about where the super committee is in just a second. But what I think is going to be really interesting is that, you know, and I've been saying that I think, you know, come spring we're going to see a regeneration of the Occupy movement, and we're going to start to see a series of general strikes that are going to lead up to a bigger general strike. But I think the other thing that we're going to see is we're going to see campaigns on a congressional level become more active. And I think we're going to see these mic checks that we're seeing in sort of isolated incidents, in more like sort of national figures, although in New York they did it with the Department of Education. I think we're going to start to see these direct actions at the campaign headquarters of candidates of both parties. And I think that's going to have a real influence in terms of these Congress people getting a real sense of what's going on in their districts. But
well, I think, you know, we're going to see at least a trial run on that, it looks like, in Iowa, where they're planning to do that at the campaign headquarters of the presidential candidates. And that should be very interesting to see how that works, to see what the reaction is. And it's not partisan. I mean, they're planning to do it on all the Republicans, but I think that President Obama has an office there, too. So that should be that's one place where they're sort of trying it out. And I think that they're trying it out in a number like town halls and various other places to see how that works. So, yeah, direct pressure on campaigns and, you know, requiring campaigns to take a position on these issues, which I think is going to be a very interesting thing and long, long overdue. I mean, you try to do it, but those politicians are slippery.
All right, so let's turn to the slippery politicians in Washington and the super committee. The deadline is November 23rd. That is, I guess, 5 days away now. And but the deadline is not really a deadline, it turns out, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, they could, you know, look, first of all, this deal, I mean, it's not written in the Constitution. It's not statutory. It's nothing. It's an agreement. They can change it if they want to. Now, they say that, well, the president has to sign off on it, but on whatever they change. But what's he going to do, you know, veto anything that's different? There's kind of a nonsensical construct around this. But
well, particularly if they defuse the trigger, right? I mean, because
exactly. Then it's nothing.
See, this is what is, I think, sort of a teachable moment for the American public now, particularly when we talk about deficit reduction. We just had a deficit, a so-called deficit reduction plan, which will ostensibly cut the budget automatically by $1 trillion, $1.2 trillion, $500 billion coming from the defense, $700 billion coming from discretionary, and some from Medicare, and on the provider side. This was the trigger, right? This was the thing that was completely inevitable.
Yep.
8 months ago, was it?
Mm-hmm.
And now we're finding out just 8 months later that you can't even make a current Congress maintain a pledge that they made to a current Congress. Never mind trying to do deficit reduction 20 or 30 years down the road in term, because you can't control that Congress. You can't even control the Congress in which is in session.
Right. And they're saying this out loud. It's not that, I mean, they're not even, you know, you've got John McCain. I think he's the one who started it. But they have Jeb Hensarling. And by the way, it should be pointed out that the people who are floating this are the Republicans who are, and I'm sure there will be Democrats joining them. In fact, there already is one, Leon Panetta, saying, well, these defense cuts, which you all agreed to, were drop dead, absolutely, would happen if you didn't come to an agreement. Well, we're not going to do those. That's just off the table. Forget about it. That won't happen. We're going to get them, you know, we're going to do it some other way. So that gives away the game instantly that, of course, this was nonsense. This was some, you know, which at the time I didn't even mind that much. I mean, they were already slashing the hell out of the budget. And right. I'm figuring, okay, can we just put off the rest of the slashing long enough for them to, you know, figure out a way out of it? Because the idea that this had to be done and that it was an absolute necessity was nonsense from the beginning. I mean, they keep putting out these numbers, this $1.2 trillion, as if the world will stop if they don't do it. That's ridiculous. Of
Hasn't
course,
John
you know.
Kerry actually said something to that effect?
Yeah.
I mean, John Kerry, who, you know, from the beginning seemed to be – I always had my eye on him at the beginning of the super committee. He's been the one who's the most vociferous. He may actually be that seventh vote for the deal. Now, give us the outlines of the deal because they're pretty bad.
Well, it's hard to know, actually.
Right.
I mean, at this point, everything's really fluid. I mean, the Republicans came up with an insane idea that, you know, we'll go ahead and agree to – raise taxes, but you have to agree to extend the Bush tax cuts forever. So basically, we'd go in the hole something like $500 billion.
No, I think it's actually more than that. As I said, over 10 years, we will raise $300 billion if you agree to extending the Bush tax cuts at a 10-year horizon of $3.7 trillion.
Oh, right. So good deal. You know, you want to jump on that? I mean, excellent. And,
that's right.
And of course,
I will give you $2 if you give me a $10. But
yes.
I will give you $2 $1 bills.
Right, and that means that we're raising taxes, by the way, which I love the fact that they're saying that that's, you know, believe me, it wasn't easy for us to get this through our people, that we were going to raise these taxes.
But that's the way that it's reported. I mean, you know, I read Ezra Klein will say that the Republicans have offered $300 billion in new taxes. And almost parenthetically, but of course, they're only doing that in exchange of continuing tax cuts of $3.7 trillion.
Let's just point out one thing here. I think one of the reasons why they're able to get away with this is because nobody in Washington, nobody on the inside believes those Bush tax cuts aren't going to be extended forever. And there's good reason for that because, you know, the last time when they had the chance to let them expire, they didn't. And it's going to be very, you know, I see no reason why that same dynamic isn't going to come into play. Now, the fact is that if they just let the Bush tax cuts expire, we no longer have a major deficit issue.
That's right. That, and within 70 years,
element.
If you control growth to the rate that it's at now, we're like 60 or 70 years out from having no debt.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely, that is the single, that's why I say, I mean, I write this every day because I'm always, you know, writing about this. Is just pray for gridlock, because the best thing that can happen is that they have to let the Bush tax cuts expire. The end, you know, forget it. You know, that's the end of it. We have no problem. Now, nobody wants to raise taxes on the middle class in the middle of this recession. I mean, and that is a sticking point. But frankly, compared to the cuts that they're about to make that are going to affect the middle class, it's the far better deal. They'd go back to the same tax rates they had at the end of the Clinton administration. not so bad. Losing your Social Security, losing Medicare, losing Medicaid for grandma when she needs to go into a nursing home, those are huge and they are real, and people would be better off paying a little bit more in taxes than giving up their entire, you know, financial security for the rest of their lives. And let's not forget about just, you know, screwing the poor people, which is what will happen if this stuff goes through. So I have no problem in just saying, you know, to me it's the simple solution. It's the best solution. It's the only one that actually will solve every problem without anybody having to do anything. Because the minute you ask these people to do something, it's going to screw average.
That's a dynamic that I think people really need to understand, because, you know, we need to get to a point. I mean, this is fantastical of my on my part, and part of that is because I've been talking to libertarians, so I'm now treading into
that
area.
I know, you made me want to go out and buy some Thai stick and get a jug of wine.
Exactly, exactly. I was trying to be polite, but I almost told our last libertarian guest, like, I'm not high enough for this conversation. the idea, you know, people hear the word taxes, and they immediately recoil in horror. But the fact of the matter is that taxes are simply bad to the extent that they're bad, and I don't actually think they're bad. We get the money back in other forms and in a more productive sense more often than not. But the idea that taxes are make things more difficult for the middle class, let's say, is simply a function of how many dollars are out of your pocket. But at the end of the day, the flip side, as you point out, what we're going to lose under the name of deficit reduction, which is a function of a lack of those taxes, is far greater than what we would pay in the taxes themselves. I mean, this is simple addition and it's simple subtraction.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is basically the argument that we should be having, which is, you know, what what are you giving, willing to give up? How much are you willing to pay for what you're getting? What, you know, this is, you know, paying taxes is paying the, otherwise known as paying the bills, right? I mean, this is what we do. And there are bills that need to be paid that actually, you know, affect how basic living standards of real human beings and having a decent society and being able to have a thriving economy and all these other things. You know, you have to pay for those. There are things that people probably would like to not pay for, like perhaps, you know, invasions of countries that didn't attack us. That's the sort of thing that's very expensive. Very expensive and useless waste of taxpayer money. But, you know, this idea that it is sacred now, that you can never raise taxes on the middle class. I mean, the last time a tax hike was done was in 1993, and I remember it. And it was as if, you know, we were voting whether or not to, you know, invade Finland. I mean, it was a huge debate. It was an unbelievably difficult thing to do. And people lost their seats over it. It ushered in Newt Gingrich. I mean, it was a hideous thing for a very, very minor tax hike. And, you know, it didn't inhibit the economy in the least to do that. But,
even when you contemplate the idea that the economy, well, I mean, part of that was that we had a burgeoning credit. I think we had more of a loose credit situation as we entered the 2000. But it certainly didn't hurt investment,
No.
You know, which is the big, it certainly didn't hurt job creation, that's for sure.
No, it certainly didn't, and I honestly don't know that the American people, if offered that, you know, if given that option, wouldn't prefer to go ahead and, you know, let those tax cuts expire the way they were, you know, allegedly designed to do, and just let's put this all behind us. I mean, the entire argument could be left. Now, of course, you know, there are ideologues in both parties, certainly among the centrists and the conservatives, that this is their moment. They believe that this is their moment to actually restructure the entire safety net. I shouldn't say restructure, basically shrink it as much as they possibly can, turn many of these programs into welfare programs, which leaves them constantly vulnerable to cuts. As we've seen with any other of those kind of programs that are mainly aimed at the poor. But, you know, this is the very fun, you know, this is the firmament of the middle class in America.
Do you think if we can get past this deadline that we are in some type of safe harbor, you know, from that perspective? In other words, we get past November 23rd. The Republicans attempt to get rid of the defense cuts. They can't just send the defense cuts to President Obama because he'll say, no, listen, we made a deal and I'm going to veto any bill that doesn't also just relinquish. If the deal's off, the deal's off. No cuts, no cuts. I would imagine that's how he's got to react, particularly as he gets closer to the election. So, I mean, if we get past this November 23rd deadline, do you think we're basically in some type of safe harbor and no more horribleness, at least in a grand scale, can happen until the 2012 election?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I do think that once that, you know, once the bubble is burst from that particular drop dead date, and people are facing election season, truly facing it. I mean, once the Iowa caucuses start in January, it's all over. They're running for office. All of them are. Then I think that we have a really good chance of everybody just kind of, you know, they'll argue about it through the election season. They'll be debating it on both sides. And unfortunately, the Democrats appear as if they want to run as, you know, the greatest deficit cutters in history. So we won't have the kind of debate that we really need to have. But nonetheless, I think the chances of anything major happening between now and the election are, you know, it gets less and less as more time passes. So I've been praying for gridlock this whole time. You know, I think the better off, you know, if we can put it off for another month by month, we're better off.
Well, from your mouth to God's ears, Digby, I am knocking on wood to signify that I'm knocking on wood. I'm not exactly sure if that's appropriate now, but it's been 8.5 hours, so I'm doing the best
exactly.
I can.
Well, you're doing well. I hope people are bringing you tea and lemon and honey and, you know, maybe some bourbon or something at this point.
Fairly soon. I think hopefully we'll have some of that coming in shortly. Well, Digby, the blog is digbysblog.blogspot.com or Hullabaloo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
The Majority Report, where the truth comes to party. BS need not apply. BS tried to apply, but we rejected its application. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
We are back. Sam Cedar on The Majority Report. That was, of course, a... what am I calling that? A sentimental favorite from the old Majority Report, John Benjamin, et cetera, et cetera. We are now officially in hour 11 of our 12-hour broadcast day today, celebrating the one-year anniversary of the relaunch of the Majority Report and the two-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. On the phone, it is always a pleasure to welcome to the program from Rolling Stone magazine, Matt Taibbi. Welcome to the program, Matt.
Wow, 11 hours, huh?
Yeah, we're going to, you know, it's another typical Thursday around here.
You guys breaking out the no-dos out there?
I've done the, I've only had to use 1 5-hour energy drink. Have you ever tried that stuff?
No, I haven't, no.
If you drink it and then sit in one place for 11 hours, it's fantastic.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It's actually fun. Probably some of the most fun I've had in a long time. Which gives you a sense of what...
That's pathetic.
It's really pathetic, yeah. No, but this is the latest I've been able to stay out since I think my child's been born.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been 6
Exciting.
Years. And
Exciting.
I've never been Exciting. Able to go out past 9:30. So, Matt, what did you think about what happened today?
Well, I mean, I guess it was, you know, I wasn't out there today.
Right.
So, but, you know, I think it's, obviously they needed to have a big response to, you know, the eviction the other day. And it sounds like they accomplished that. So that's great. I mean, I don't know. What do you think about it?
Well, I mean, I think it was a great show of force, and I think you know, it would have been a real drag if somehow people had let what happened with the eviction demoralize them. And I think it's
right.
Clear that it hasn't. And you know, I think the real challenge over the next couple of weeks is going to be how do you what is phase two of this movement, at least, you know, in terms of New York and perhaps other cities across the country, because it seems to have been either a massive coincidence or, you know, some coordination as to this is the time we want to roll it up when people start
right.
thinking about buying Christmas presents and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I mean, I think they got to stick it out in New York somehow. And New York is the symbolic center of this whole thing. And if Bloomberg succeeds in rolling everybody up and demoralizing everybody and somehow making it too uncomfortable for people to stay out there, I think that'll be really deflating. So they got to figure out some way to keep some kind of presence out there, I think, you know, through the winter somehow. That's my feeling. I don't know how you think about it, but I think they got to stick it out and then hope to regroup in the spring.
Well, I mean, I've always been of the opinion that the spring is going to be the most important time, and that things
sure.
are going to quiet down over the winter in one way or another. And I think the important thing is sort of to get out there and redefine the movement in exile. I mean, you know, in the diaspora, as it was,
right.
I guess, of,
right.
Of Liberty Square. And I think some presence would be good, you know, physical presence. But I think, you know, I can also envision where you have somebody mentioned tonight that there was a building at the New School that was occupied tonight. And, you know, if you have a series of that, that are the sort of like, you know, coordinated flash mob type of stuff, then I think there's a way to keep the Occupy, the movement in the forefront of people's minds that,
right.
you know, so it remains to be seen, but certainly, you know, it's better that they were evicted from the park than just decided to, you know, peter out.
Right.
And
right.
I'm not saying that was going to happen, but I think now that's not a concern as much as just trying to figure out what's the next stage.
Sure. I think, you know, I personally think it was a huge tactical mistake by Bloomberg to, you know, send in the stormtroopers and get everybody out. He would have been much smarter, I thought, to sort of use the Operation Barbarossa method and just let the winter take care of the crowds. This way, you know, he provided a real visual for the movement to rally around, and he also gave them kind of an enemy to coalesce against. You know, if they can somehow defy this eviction order, that just it provides a more emotional fuel for the whole thing. And we'll see what happens. I think today kind of indicates to me that. That they got some energy out of what Bloomberg did and not the other way around.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So let me ask you this, just sort of like looking to other issues in the news. We just had a caller that wanted me to ask you about Joe Walsh. I assume they're talking about not the singer, but rather the congressman from Illinois who not only seems to be sort of like personally speaking, sort of, I don't know, can I say douchebag? But also, like, I've never seen a guy who was so adamant and so wrong simultaneously. This whole notion about the financial crisis being caused by the government, we heard Bloomberg say it the other day. We heard Joe Walsh say it the other day. This has got to be infuriating to a guy like you who has reported on exactly what the causes were.
Yeah. Look, people on Wall Street, when people who are the source, you know, the kind of sources that I talk to all the time, when people hear this explanation that the government caused the financial crisis, it's like a joke. You know, people laugh out loud at this idea that the government forced the banks to lend to unworthy borrowers. It wasn't like that at all. Clearly, there was a lot of stuff that went on. The government did make it easier for people of low means to get mortgages, but that wasn't what propelled the bubble. What propelled the bubble was this explosion of new derivative instruments that allowed banks to sell worthless, risky subprime mortgages as AAA rated securities. I know that sounds complicated, but really all it means is they went out and they issued as many loans as they possibly could to anybody with a pulse because they knew they could sell the stuff as something that was more valuable than a U.S. Treasury bill to foreign wealth funds, to unions, to mutual funds, to retirees. That was why they were making all these loans. It wasn't because they were forced to. It was because they were making trillions of dollars selling this stuff.
And they would resell. They would resell these over and over again.
Oh yeah. Well, not only would they resell them over and over again, but they created synthetic instruments based on these mortgages. What they would do is you'd have a subprime package of subprime mortgages. And then you would write a whole bunch of swaps against those mortgages, which are essentially bets on those mortgages, right? And then you would sell those, and then you could write bets against those and bets against those. They were essentially making Xerox copies of all these mortgages and selling them because it was enormously profitable. It had nothing to do with the government forcing the banks to do this. They didn't need to push at all. It was just that they were making so much money doing it. The statistic I like to cite a lot is when the crisis happened, they could have paid off every subprime mortgage in the country for like $1.5 trillion, but the bailouts ended up being about five times that amount because we weren't paying off the mortgages, we were paying off the bets on these mortgages. So there was so much action on these mortgages. Wall Street was making so much money off of these underlying assets that they didn't need a push from the government. It's a fairy tale that is used by uneducated people, in Congress and Rush Limbaugh and places like that.
Well, what do you think Bloomberg's? I mean, what do you think Bloomberg's agenda? And when he spreads those lies, is it simply because he knows he can? I mean, he just basically says. I mean, that's basically his way of saying like, look, just don't mess with the financial companies in this city because they're my base.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I made this point in an article a couple of weeks ago. You know, it's one thing when Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity trots out that line or Joe Walsh. It's at least theoretically conceivable that these guys are dumb enough that they actually might believe that. But Mike Bloomberg's a Wall Street guy. I mean, he knows how this business operates. He knows that they were creating these loans as fast as they possibly could in order to sell them and make money. So when he did that, it was a conscious deception, clearly, that I think he made at the behest of his buddies on Wall Street. They wanted somebody to deflect blame from them and take a bullet for them, and I think that's what he was doing.
There was a report that came out today from the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse at Syracuse University. Which I'm sure you spent a lot of time reading their newsletter, which is actually really fun. I don't know if you've ever been to one of those Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse barbecues.
But not for a couple of years.
But the track report compiles Justice Department data through Freedom of Information Act. Yeah, you know this. Federal prosecution for financial crimes are down a 20-year low,
right.
Specifically financial institution fraud, down. It's no surprise, right? I mean, what are the factors involved in that?
Well, there's a bunch of things. I think the main thing is that 20 years ago, it was routine for the various regulatory agencies that do not have prosecutorial power. The financial services industry has a whole bunch of regulators. Some of them are completely governmental, like the OCC, which is basically a banking regulator. There used to be the OTS, which was a savings and loan regulator, the Fed. But then there was the quasi-private ones, like the New York Stock Exchange and FINRA, which governs the Securities Dealers Association. It used to be routine for all of these regulators, whenever they caught a problem, they would do what they call criminal referrals. They would basically prepare cases, they would investigate cases, and then refer them to the Justice Department for prosecution. And they used to do thousands and thousands of these referrals every year. A great case in point was the savings and loan industry, where there were upwards of 10,000 referrals during that period from groups like the OTS. And
Bill Black was one of those guys.
Bill Black was one of those guys. Now it's basically, you know, if they have 10 referrals a year from some of those agencies, it's a lot. They've just stopped doing those referrals. So that's one main factor. And the other main factor is that there's just simply no more political will to prosecute Wall Street. It's just they don't make these cases anymore. And what they're doing instead is they're making the easy cases with drug dealers and low-level street criminals because that gets more headlines, and they're also easier to prosecute. So that's the main factor.
So there's basically on the political side, it's basically been an undercutting of one element of the process, and then there's also sort of the pragmatic aspects that have slowed it down. But you know, I mean, I hear the one thing that's the one referral that really sticks out for me is this referral that I guess came from a division of HUD about 2 years ago about the mortgage reinsurance scams that the banks were running. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where the banks would require mortgage insurance, and they would set up a subsidiary that would reinsure the initial insurer, but not take the risk, but take the premiums.
Right.
I mean, this type of thing, it really just simply is that this is just the a too big to fail mentality. I spoke to Glenn Greenwald today earlier about this notion of injustice for some, or I can't, you know, forgive me, it's been a long day as to what the title was,
but yeah, I know,
but it was specifically about this idea that there that we now live in a society where the laws simply don't apply to certain people in our society.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a member of Congress, a guy who works for an investigatory committee on the Hill, forward a case to me yesterday. A single mother in Mississippi was arrested. Apparently, in Mississippi, if you have a felony conviction in your past, you're not eligible for food stamps. This woman lied about that in her application. She got food stamps. They gave her 3 years in jail for taking $4,000 worth of food stamps, and she had already paid the money back, and they still gave her the prison time. And that's what we're seeing on the one hand. On the other hand,
and we should say that the total cost of her fraud was about $4,400.
Yeah, $4,400. Yeah, exactly. $4,376 was the total, right? And so you hear on the other hand, you have, you know, there was a case last week involving Citigroup, where they committed a $700 million fraud, and it was a type of fraud that they had been specifically enjoined against committing. They had been slapped with injunctions three times already, the same unit of the same company, and they had ignored these injunctions over and over again. They commit a $700 million fraud, and it's one of several similar frauds in the company, and the SEC settles with them for $285 million. Which is only about $100 million more than they made in profits on the deal, and no individual had to suffer. Nobody went to jail. No individual had to pay a fine. So that's the standard right now. You know, somebody who lies to get food stamps goes to prison, and somebody who repeatedly commits, you know, billion-dollar frauds does not go to jail.
I love the idea though that a company has to be enjoined from committing the same fraud again.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, that. Look, that's part of what's so incredible about this is that the reason these guys get these incredible deals from the regulators where they don't have to admit to wrongdoing, right? The typical way that these guys settle is they do a financial settlement that's generally a fractional amount of damage, right? And they settle only after the regulators promise not to leave them open to civil liability, so they can settle without having to admit to wrongdoing. But you know, in order to get that, they have to promise never to do it again, right? So they go before a judge, they promise never to do it again, and then 18 months later they're committing the same crime. And if any other kind of criminal were to do the same thing, if you were to be dragged before the same judge for committing the same crime over and over again, well, they would throw the book at you, and they just do not do it with these companies. They continue to get off the hook for committing the same crimes over and over again, and that's why we're seeing this William Black, the guy you mentioned, he was talking about 1 million fraud cases a year. I think that's actually conservative if you look at the robo-signing efforts that all these banks are involved with. It's epidemic.
Yeah, in Nevada, there was a law essentially passed, I guess, in October, which said that if you come into court with an affidavit that says that you actually own a mortgage and you don't, there's some type of criminal liability, and foreclosures dropped by 95%.
Right.
Just because basically they said, hey, when you sign that affidavit, you're basically saying I'm not lying. Well, we really mean you're not supposed to lie. And then all of a sudden the foreclosures dried up at that point because they were all afraid to sign the affidavits. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, people think that the whole robo-signing thing is I thought it's mythical or it's occasional. You know, when I was in a foreclosure court in Florida last year, and before I went into the court, some of the defense attorneys were telling me the names of local robo-signers, people whose names kept appearing in a lot of these judgments. And as I was sitting through these cases, I heard those names over and over and over again. Like literally every single foreclosure case that came through this courtroom had perjury in it. It had robo-signed evidence in it. So the entire system is infected with this stuff. It's not like, here and there. It's like literally every single case. So it's you're absolutely right. If they were to actually start punishing it, the foreclosures would dry up completely because there are virtually no legitimate foreclosure actions anymore. That doesn't mean people aren't delinquent. It just means that the paperwork that's screwed up all the way across the board.
It means that there's no chain of title.
Right, exactly.
Is recognized by literally property laws that predate the United States of America.
It's
one of the oldest things you learn in law school is sort of these archaic laws of property and how that you need a proper chain of title is sort of one of the cornerstones of property law.
So
let me ask you this. When Citigroup keeps breaking the same law over and over again,
right,
and they go back in front of the judge, what do they basically say? Like, it's a couple of guys down in our Queens office, and we just didn't know what they were doing. Is that basically it?
I mean,
what do they say?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Do they do the Dr. Richard Kimball, was the one-armed man in this department? I have no idea what they're actually saying. Clearly they don't admit to wrongdoing during any part of the process. They always say that it's an unintentional fraud. So for them to admit that they broke the same rule over and over again, that never actually happens. The judge always has to admonish them himself. So I don't know that they're ever admitting to it. But clearly it's happening over and over again. Goldman also has the same thing over and over again. They've been repeatedly slapped with the same kinds of violations. So, I guess it's just the judges aren't upset by it.
And what's ultimately going to change this? Anything? I mean, is it, are we going to see the dissolution of, too big to fail, banks and their power, or are we going to see strengthened regulatory infrastructure first, assuming we just don't keep going on like this?
I think that they're going to try to figure out a way to just keep going on like this. I mean, I was at a conference for consumer attorneys, the kind of people who defend against foreclosures, in Chicago a couple of weeks ago. And they were talking about this foreclosure settlement that the AGs are cooking up in conjunction with the OCC and the Obama administration. All that robo-signed evidence that we're talking about, I mean, if they were to allow all of those lawsuits to proceed against all of that activity, all of these banks would be out of business because they've committed so much fraud and so much crime that all of the people who were defrauded could easily take him to court and take him, put him all out of business. So what's going to happen is, I think they're going to come up with some kind of, you know, new sort of by fiat dictum that just absolves all of these companies for all of that behavior. And, you know, normally when you do like a global settlement that gives people waivers of civil liability, you have to get the permission of all the people who might sue.
Right.
In other words, they have to be involved in the settlement. But I think they're not going to be able to do that this time. So they're just going to have to just do a papal bull that exculpates all of these banks for all that behavior. And I expect that to happen. I think that's the only way out for them.
But I mean, can states' attorney generals, do they have the authority to essentially provide get out of jail free card for these type of fraud? In other words, or at least from the civil obligations. The state attorney generals can't do this. I mean, I suppose by legislation, the Congress could say, like, hey, you know that requirement that everybody has where you need to have a chain of title? Well, we're going to, grandfather.
Right, yeah, no, they don't. I mean, if you're just thinking in terms of how the law normally works, right, you couldn't really do that, right? I mean, not according to any legal process that we're familiar with, but that doesn't mean that I think they're still going to do it. I mean, the expectation is they're going to come up with some
super law.
Yeah, exactly. Super law, an executive order, or a piece of legislation, some negotiated settlement that Congress somehow signs off on. I mean, nobody knows exactly what form it's going to take, but that they're just going to have to make something up. There's just no other.
Do you think
no
they can get Schneiderman and Bo Biden on board?
No, I don't think so. And Kamala Harris in California is also balking at the whole thing. So, you know, if you don't have New York and California, it's going to be pretty hard to enforce anything. But I still think they're going to try. I mean, that's what I keep hearing, is that this is still kind of underway. And, you know, they're moving towards some kind of settlement. But at the same time, you know, Schneiderman's still proceeding with his investigation of the same stuff. So they haven't reined him in yet, and that could be really interesting to see what happens there.
All right, well, Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone Magazine, I can't tell you how much I appreciate. I know this is very late for you. I know usually.
Hey, well, congratulations! You must be psyched to be commemorating all that. How long ago did you start the show?
Well, I mean, the Majority Report started in 2004, but we relaunched it a year ago today.
Right. I remember going on with you and Janine ages ago when she was that puppy. Remember that?
Oh yeah, Janine used to bring her dog into the into the studio, and it would eat it up. And yes, well, all of those dogs I think have passed away.
Oh no.
Yeah, I don't mean
depressing.
To bring.
Well,
it,
on that note.
Yes, on dead puppies. Matt Taibbi, Rolling Stone Magazine. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
All right. Congratulations, Matt.
Thanks.
Sitting up the pain.